WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking on this portion of the morning show about something which is called the Forbidden Bookshelf. It's actually a website, www.forbiddenbookshelf.com. And it is an opportunity for us to access a handful of intriguing books in e-book format, books which have all but vanished from public shelves. In a sense, not officially banned, but perhaps in certain ways suppressed because of their controversial content. And this is of great interest on a number of different levels to my morning show guest, Mark Crispin Miller, who is a professor at NYU, where he teaches about the media. He is a cultural historian and writer on the topic of the media, its pervasive presence in our lives, its influence over what we think and do and how we view the world. Perhaps you have seen his writing in the New York Times, New Republic, The Atlantic, among many other places. He's been featured in a number of different documentaries and so on. A well-known presence on radio, including a number of different NPR programs. And I am really grateful for this opportunity to speak with Mark Crispin Miller about this thing called the Forbidden Bookshelf and some of the books which one finds on it, in it, through this website. Professor Mark Crispin Miller, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Could I find out first from you where you first got so interested in the media itself? I mean, interested to the point that you have really made it the primary focus of your professional energies, at least to a very, very great extent.
Yeah.
Where did this begin? Did it begin for you as someone who was just one more consumer of the media, who somehow crossed over a line and became interested in media on kind of a different level?
Well, I try to cross as many lines as possible. Well, the question is, I guess, an interesting one, at least to me. I started writing about the media as a graduate student in English back in the 70s, although it had nothing to do with my academic work. I was studying the literature of the English Renaissance. Shakespeare was my specialty. But on my own, on the side, as it were, I started teaching film courses and writing about the movies, just out of love of cinema. And then as the 70s progressed went on, I began to notice that a lot of the visual devices used in the movies were also being used in various kinds of commercial and political propaganda. So I started writing for a public audience on aspects of TV and advertising. And that's when most of the pieces that you sort of indirectly referred to in introducing me came out, you know, for magazines like The New Republic and so on. Later, having embarked on a career as a media critic, I took to writing books myself on subjects that struck me as terribly important, and one of them, on the theft of the 2004 election, called Fooled Again, was itself suppressed, and this piqued my interest in the problem of books that are disappeared in unofficial ways. As you rightly noted at first, you know, we don't ban books in the United States. We have a First Amendment. And when some puritanical school board off in the provinces tries to get a book removed from the school library shelves, or when a bunch of biddies get together and try to get a book taken out of the local libraries, it's always a cause for legitimate concern. And there are groups formed to fight that kind of outright censorship. And these are usually books that offend people's sensibilities. They're too dirty, or they're unchristian, or they're unpatriotic. The Forbidden Bookshelf is not about that kind of thing. I think it's fairly easy to oppose that sort of outright banning of books, because that just rubs us the wrong way as Americans. Most of us Americans feel that way. The Forbidden Bookshelf is about books whose disappearance has been much more subtly managed. It's a kind of imperceptible banning. And I would argue that there are books whose disappearance is far more consequential and worrisome than the merely local and intermittent suppression of books like Howl or The Bluest Eye. We're talking here about books that delve into some of the darkest trends and episodes in our national history, books that really help us understand how it is we got to where we are today, with grotesque economic inequality, in effect the suspension of our most fundamental civil rights, a war machine that's really out of control, that's bigger by far than all the other nations' war machines combined. I mean, I could go on and on. How did we get here? How did this happen? How did we end up in a kind of an imperial position? Well, I think that the library of books that we're bringing back through the Forbidden Bookshelf helps us understand how this happened.
Let's talk a moment about how we even determine that a given book has been the subject of, let's call it, unofficial suppressive efforts.
Yeah, right.
Versus a book which simply was not found compelling by enough people to purchase it, and which just ended up languishing for any number of reasons, some of which might be perfectly regrettable, but not nearly as sinister as the picture you have just painted.
Right.
First of all, how does one determine the difference between those books which are just sort of unfortunate losers in the marketplace versus those that have been the victim of something else that you would view as much more ominous?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Well, you know, those books that just couldn't hack it commercially are books that got a fair shot at reaching their ideal readerships. They're books that were duly published in the best sense, that is, they were publicized and widely reviewed. I'm talking here about books that were sidelined, sometimes in spectacular ways. For example, we've brought back DuPont Dynasty, Behind the Nylon Curtain by Gerard Colby. This is a real masterpiece. It's quite long. It was the result of many years' labor on Colby's part, and it tells the whole story, the whole history of the DuPont family ever since their arrival in the United States in the early 19th century, how they rose to prominence by cornering the national market on gunpowder, how they expanded into a much more powerful weapons manufacturer entity, and then evolved into the biggest chemical concern in the United States. And from there, mutated into a major financial power. This is a book, let me say that because the DuPonts wielded so much influence, many, many aspects of their true history were never adequately reported, such as, for example, their heavy involvement in the attempted coup, the coup that was planned in 1934 to oust FDR from the White House using an army of 500,000 military veterans led, they hoped, by Marine General Smedley Butler, who actually played along with them just to find out what they were planning and then testified before Congress about what they were up to. This is a story that even at the time was largely laughed off by the press in this country, precisely because the DuPonts were too big to tangle with. I mean, that's going back several decades. The book, DuPont Dynasty, takes us through their entire history, which is replete with examples of, brutal suppression of labor strikes, the formation of an outfit called the Black Legion in Detroit, which was modeled on the Ku Klux Klan and whose function was to deal with labor dissidents in General Motors workforce. DuPont owned a huge piece of General Motors for a long time. They have created many a kind of witch's brew of industrial toxins that have carcinogenic effects. I mean, you know, I'm just giving you the tip of the iceberg here. The point is, in answer to your question, the DuPont family actually engineered the suppression of DuPont Dynasty when it first came out in 1974, and actually got the first publisher, Prentice Hall, to collude with them on this, and the author therefore sued Prentice Hall over it. A second edition of the book came out in 1984 from a different publisher, and somehow, strangely enough, it turned out that the first print run of that second edition had been badly damaged. Specifically, the 30 pages dealing with the suppression of the first edition were all missing from a significant number of the printed copies of the second edition, so that the book ended up not being in sufficient supply to make it possible for the publisher to make a profit on it. From there, the book slipped out of print completely, had kind of legendary status. Now we've brought it back with a new introduction by Colby. That's a long story. I can tell you much more briefly that similar things have happened with a number of the other books we've done. The CIA tried to prevent Douglas Valentine from completing his book, The Phoenix Program, which is an indispensable book about the Vietnam War and about the notorious CIA program that was mounted in South Vietnam for several years under William Colby, who later became the head of the CIA. Valentine had to sue in order to be able to interview people and get the book completed. And I could go on. Now, there are some books on the list that were not so, you used the word sinister, but that slipped out of print, I don't think as a result of any conscious plot, but simply because you might say the book's disappearance might be regarded as sort of convenient, that maybe publishers just really didn't want to bother. The books go against the grain. One of the ones we've done that's extremely successful, and this is kind of remarkable, was actually published way back in 1935. It's called The Lords of Creation. It's a history of the takeover of the American economy by financial interests like the House of Morgan. This was a big bestseller in 1935. The book is by Frederick Lewis Allen, a very successful popular historian. He was editor of Harper's Magazine for a while. This was the only book of Allen's that had fallen out of print. He wrote a book called Only Yesterday, came out also in the 30s, and another one called Since Yesterday, Popular Histories of the United States, that have continued to be in print, continued to sell through the decades. Only The Lords of Creation was unavailable, so we have brought it out again with a new introduction by Gretchen Morgenson, the financial reporter from the New York Times, who sees it and describes it rightly as an essential book, essential to an understanding of how Wall Street has continued to operate ever since 1935, and I'm pleased to say, you know, the book is selling really impressively. Most of the books we've done have stories that their authors tell of deliberate suppression. in one way or another. Some of them have simply and conveniently sort of slipped off the radar screen. Basically, they're all books that should be in print, and thanks to this series, they will be again. My only regret is that they're not also available as actual books, being myself an incurable lover of, you know, books you can handle and write in the margins and so on. But that kind of thing is unfortunately not economically feasible anymore. Maybe someday we'll be able to do a print-on-demand edition of some of these books. But for now, they're e-books, and they do have new introductions and have been re-edited in some cases where they, you know, weren't edited sufficiently to begin with.
We're speaking with Mark Crispin Miller about this series called The Forbidden Bookshelf, books that have slipped out of print that are now available again in e-book format on the website www.forbiddenbookshelf.com. You keep referring to we, as in, you know, a book which we have decided should come back to print or and so on. I think it would be good for us to understand who we is and whoever we is. I mean, whatever kind of organization or group of scholars is part of this effort. What is the process by which you determine that a book deserves to be part of the Forbidden Bookshelf project and be brought back to the public?
Well, it's a much simpler process than my inadvertent use of the royal plural implied here. I mean, it works this way, you know. At first, it was just a matter of my suggesting certain titles that over the years I'd been unable to assign my classes, for example, or books that I whose suppression I learned about by talking to the authors. I have to persuade my editors at Open Road that these books would command a readership sufficient to justify republication. So when I say we, I mean initially myself and the editors I work with at the publishing company. Since we've started the series, I've been, you know, helped by a lot of people who simply contact me and suggest titles to me that I hadn't known of. I mean, I have to say that one of the really startling things about this project has been my own discovery of so many more books than I even realized were out there, and that had just disappeared. I mean, if I, who am maybe obsessively interested in this kind of phenomenon, hadn't heard of a book, then wow, you know, I tell myself it's really been buried. Now, often these books that people suggest turn out to be in print still. It's just that they haven't been published for a very long time. There's a certain amount of detective work involved here because we can't republish these books without getting the rights to do so. So often it's a matter of tracking down the author or the author's survivors and persuading them to participate with us in this republication. And in most cases, people are happy to do so. There are, I have to tell you, you know, getting back into the land of the sinister, there have been books whose authors or whose authors' survivors are afraid to bring the books back, you know, which is troubling, to say the least. But there's nothing I can do about it. I can't force somebody to have a book come out again. Suffice it to say that, you know, this whole project raises an important civic question for all of us to consider, and that is how much free expression do we really have in the United States? I mean, there are various ways to answer that question. We have an administration in power now that's used the Espionage Act more than all of the previous presidencies combined to punish unauthorized revelation of various state secrets. that may seem to be a subject far removed from the one we're discussing, but I actually don't think it is. You know, the suicide of Aaron Swartz over his having downloaded a lot of scholarly journals on an MIT chat room site. And you know, this for this he was sort of harassed and persecuted by the federal government and ended up killing himself. You know, these kinds of disparate acts of suppression or strokes of suppression, these various ways in which information is bottled up, all of this, I think, puts into question how committed the United States remains to the fundamental principles of free speech that were enshrined in the Constitution, not just the First Amendment, but, you know, our copyright clause and so on. I mean, copyright now has become something monopolized by and large by huge corporations concerned with maintaining intellectual property rights for as long as possible. So, I mean, in other words, the importance of this particular book series relates to a far more important, larger question that you know, we would discuss in other shows, presumably, because it ranges much further and wider than just this. But, you know, books are not as glamorous a form of expression as movies and TV shows and so on, and newspapers. So, you know, I think it's important that we pay close attention to how books have disappeared, because books are such an important repository of so much rich and detailed information. Books give us so comprehensive an understanding of the subjects they deal with, as opposed to tweets, you know?
Right, exactly.
And news articles and so on.
Right. What about the possibility that someone is hearing this conversation and finds themselves reminded of more outrageous conspiracy theories that might be put forth by someone who's written a book about Roswell or alien abductions or something and feels like there are forces out there suppressing valuable information that needs to be shared with the public about matters like that? In what way can we think about this project and your concerns apart from those kind of conspiracy theories, which I think most intelligent people would agree are a bit more outrageous in and self-serving in nature?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the things I wanted to accomplish with this series was precisely a rethinking of that epithet, conspiracy theory, because a number of the books we're doing were indeed dismissed by reviewers as conspiracy theories. Not because the books were sloppily researched or expressions of psychosis. On the contrary, such works were so dismissed precisely because they were so sound and told stories that were so potentially explosive that it was necessary to find some way to discourage people from reading them. You know, as the author of a book of my own, as I think I mentioned on the theft of the 2004 election, I was myself accused of conspiracy theory, and that book was lumped together with other serious treatments of that election and books on the real problem of election fraud in the United States. All these books were laughed off as conspiracy theory, and that experience actually led me to do a little historical research on how and when that phrase, conspiracy theory, entered the universe of journalistic discourse. When did that happen? Because Americans have historically not been unduly concerned about being accused of lunacy if they dare to call attention to certain kinds of elite conspiracies. I mean, you could read the Declaration of Independence as a conspiracy theory. It certainly reads like one. You know, it does read like
right.
one. And yet, you know, our nation was more or less founded on the basis of that document. I discovered that the phrase actually entered journalism in this country fairly recently. not until the late 60s. And it was specifically in relation to some books that had come out questioning the results of the Warren Commission report on JFK's assassination.
Hmm.
Well, it turns out that the CIA actually instructed all of its station chiefs worldwide in the spring of 1967 to discredit these books and even offered five different arguments that could be used to discredit them, and instructed the station chiefs addressed in the memo to get their propaganda assets and friends in the media, and I'm quoting the document when I use that phrase, to write reviews of these books and use these arguments as a way to shoot these books down. Now, I found this so remarkable that the phrase was never really used by the New York Times or the Washington Post or Time magazine until 1967, and I searched their archives to prove this, that I encouraged a scholar at Florida Atlantic University, Lance DeHaven Smith, to write a book about this whole thing, and he did, and I published it in a different series that I edited there. It's called Conspiracy Theory in America. Again, his name is Lance DeHaven Smith. It's a hyphenated name, and it's a very careful and extremely important history of how that notion has been used precisely to discourage people from taking seriously certain kinds of inquiries into various, state and corporate deeds. It is a very important thing. You're having asked me tacitly, how can I justify editing a series that sounds uncomfortably like the kinds of works that we all thoughtfully agree are beyond the pale. I've actually become a kind of radical skeptic on these questions. I don't actually think we should dismiss any kind of inquiry, any kind of concern, just because other people have rolled their eyes and snickered about it. I think we should always take the time simply to look into each of those concerns and decide for ourselves on the basis of the evidence whether or not there's anything there. I certainly do agree with Lance DeHaven Smith, who argues in his book that the sudden and recent reluctance to consider the possibility of elite conspiracy is somehow fundamentally un-American, that there is really nothing at all unreasonable about our assumption that people at the top will try inexplicitly and conspiratorially to deprive us of our rights or to separate us from our money. I mean, America was founded on the assumption that power is untrustworthy, that a successful republic must be based on an effort to break up power at the top, to separate powers, to divide power, and to make sure that we never have a monarch again, or we don't have a kind of elite senatorial body that can function with impunity. I think we've come perilously close to that kind of system again since 9/11. With the war on terror, the government now has carte blanche to do things that we never would have tolerated them even considering 20 or 30 years ago. So, again, the purpose of Forbidden Bookshelf isn't simply to bring back as many of these very important books as possible, but it's also meant to get us to kind of free our minds from this sort of reflexive reaction that many people have who will say about something that is patently suspicious, well, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I don't know if you've heard people say that. I've heard people say that many times, and that's very telling, because often common sense tells you that there's something fishy going on, and we ought not to be cowed by a kind of journalistic consensus that there's nothing to see here.
Right. And it's as though that's the worst thing you could be accused of being, is a conspiracy theorist, if you are a seriously thinking person. And what you're saying is we really need to be wary of a culture in which that becomes something with which you can be branded, when in fact it's an important function that many people have served in our past and our present, and we hope in our future as well.
Well, that's, you put it much more succinctly than I did. That's absolutely true, and I will add that, you know, there are real consequences to be suffered for straying into those forbidden grounds. I mean, if you're a journalist and you go anywhere near some of these subjects, you're finished. It's professional suicide. And it's true for some academics as well. You know, this is a kind of, this, it's not like we're living in Russia or Iran where discouragement is explicit and sometimes brutal. I would argue that it's even worse when you live in a nation that constantly boasts of and pats itself on the back for its absolutely free expression, when in fact there are quite a number of subjects that people are afraid to talk about. They're afraid to discuss in a rational and impartial way, a dispassionate way, 9/11 or vaccines or certain assassinations or Zionism. There really are serious limitations on free expression in the United States, and you know, the forbidden bookshelf is one way to sort of talk back against that trend and to get people to think about it critically.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking on this portion of the morning show with Mark Crispin Miller, who is a media critic, cultural historian, and a professor at NYU, where he teaches about various issues related to the media and their influence on all of us. And we are talking on today's morning show about a project he is part of called The Forbidden Bookshelf, in which an array of books thought to be important, but books which for various regrettable reasons have fallen out of print, perhaps never printed in the first place, are shared with the public in ebook format. The third installment of the Forbidden Bookshelf Project has just been released. And Professor Miller, I want to give you an opportunity to run down the books which are part of this third installment of the Forbidden Bookshelf. I know at least one or two have been briefly mentioned through the course of the morning show, but I think they should probably be mentioned again. And then by all means, talk about the other books that are also part of the Forbidden Bookshelf's third installment.
Well, thanks for that. In fact, we haven't talked about any of these four latest titles yet. I'm grateful for an opportunity to do that. What I want to stress here is how relevant these books each remain for different reasons. Let's take the recent revelation of the extensive use of torture by the CIA abroad. This has come out because of the executive summary of the Senate report on CIA torture that was released so controversially a few months ago, with the CIA insisting that their use of torture was always productive and yielded tons of actionable intelligence and so on, against all the factual evidence. Well, I think it's important that we understand the history of such self-delusion within the CIA. One way to do that is to return to a number of books that were written by CIA insiders themselves in the 70s and 80s. A Forbidden Bookshelf includes several of these volumes, and the latest one that we've now published is called Deadly Deceits, My 25 Years with the CIA by Ralph McGehee, which came out in 1983, and which deals with his experience of the CIA, specifically his sort of traumatic discovery that the CIA was actually not interested in the facts that he, as a CIA analyst, was discovering about Vietnam and the conflict there. What they wanted was the kind of intelligence that the president and the National Security Council wanted. In other words, there was pressure on him as an analyst to come up with the information that the government of the United States preferred to hear, so that what he was giving them was basically ignored. He found out as well that the news media were often, more often than not, reporting as fact stories that had been fed them by the CIA. His understanding of CIA self-deception began from the moment he first started training with them in the early 50s, when they were all heavily indoctrinated in sort of anti-communist dogma from the moment they entered the so-called farm, the camp where they all received their training. It's a remarkable book. And when McGehee wrote it and it came out, he found that he was being really kind of frighteningly harassed by CIA colleagues, or I guess he was no longer in the agency, so they weren't colleagues, but CIA people were stalking him in his hometown in Virginia. They were making his life extremely difficult, and he ended up having to move up to New England. We have a new introduction by another former CIA officer named David McMichael, who points up the relevance of Deadly Deceits to subsequent history. But it's a really gripping and important book that people should read. The second book that continues to resonate today is a very important volume that actually has never been published before. It's by I.F. Stone, the legendary independent journalist. And its title is Underground to Palestine and Other Writings on the Middle East. Underground to Palestine is a short book that Stone published in 1946, and it's a record of his underground journey to Palestine and his report on what was going on there. This is before the creation of Israel. But what we've done is to include in this volume all of Stone's writings on Israel and Palestine, many excerpts from a later book he wrote called This is Israel. It came out in 1949. And then all of his journalistic writings on Israel over the course of the next decade or so in various newspapers, and particularly his own publication, I.F. Stone's Weekly. Now, let me pause for a moment to talk about another book that we had already done by Stone, because it's actually relevant here. Underground to Palestine did get some reviews. It got some attention, even though Stone was a very left-wing figure. But in 1952, he published The Hidden History of the Korean War, which is just a masterpiece. Some 36 American publishers turned down that manuscript. He had a very hard time getting it published at all. It was finally published by Monthly Review Press, which is sort of a Marxist house in New York. And from that moment on, Stone was a pariah. His career went into total eclipse for about 18 years, and This is Palestine and his other works were completely forgotten. The Hidden History of the Korean War is a masterpiece of careful, meticulous reporting based on a thorough study of government documents. It tells the story of how the U.S. deliberately prolonged the war in Korea as a way to jumpstart the military-industrial complex and to take care of a range of various other political problems at the time. It is such a careful and sort of irrefutable study that Stone could not have, be forgiven for having written it, because it was completely contrary to the official narratives of a surprise attack by the North Koreans and our totally defensive response to communist aggression for the next couple of years or so. It's a beautifully written book. Anyway, suffice it to say that the fate of the hidden history of the Korean War sort of retroactively suppressed underground to Palestine.
Wow.
And turned Stone into a sort of an underground dissident reporter. So what we've now done is put together in this one volume all his writings on Israel and Palestine. And the reason why it's so important today is that it offers a kind of critical response still from within the camp of Zionism, a critical response to the sort of aggressive, anti-democratic, racist, warlike strain of Zionism that's represented by Netanyahu and the Likud party. The last work in this volume is called The Other Zionism, which makes an argument for a Zionism that really is democratic, that's progressive, that includes the Arab citizens of the country. So, wherever one stands on this extremely controversial issue today, I think it's essential that they get hold of this unprecedented volume of Stone's writings on the subject.
Again, we should reiterate the title, Underground to Palestine and Other Writings on Israel, Palestine, and the Middle East by I.F. Stone.
That's right. So that's the second of the four books that we're bringing out now.
Mm-hmm.
The third is called The Hoffa Wars. This is about Jimmy Hoffa and his tempestuous tenure as head of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters. And then he ended up in prison for his criminal activities, and then was ultimately assassinated by precisely whom we don't know. The mob was certainly involved. The CIA was possibly involved. But this book by veteran crime reporter Dan Moldea is a really essential work for a number of reasons. First of all, it's relevant to the shattered state of the labor movement today, because the story of Jimmy Hoffa and his associates is a story of the corruption of the union movement and its seizure by elements of organized crime. And Hoffa was involved in that up to his eyeballs, even though he later managed to craft a reputation as a persistent fighter for the working man. This is largely mythology. It was Hoffa who appears to have been the one who brought the CIA and organized crime together for their long covert partnership in attempting to assassinate Fidel Castro. And that partnership arguably had a great deal to do with the eventual assassination of John Kennedy. The Hoffa Wars tells the whole story of the struggles over the Teamsters, the struggles within the Teamsters, the struggles between the Teamsters and dissident workers who tried to reform the organization. It also has a great deal to tell us about the astonishing corruption of Richard Nixon's presidency and his very close relations with the mafia.
Hmm.
And also it has a fair amount about the connections between Hoffa and the Kennedys. Hoffa detested the Kennedy brothers, especially Bobby, who, as Attorney General, devoted himself to putting Hoffa in prison. There is, considerable evidence in the book that Hoffa had, at the very least, an interest in seeing that John Kennedy was assassinated. Anyway, Dan Moldea is a terrific reporter. It's an indispensable book, and it's the second of his books that we're doing. We have also done his book, Interference, about the involvement of the National Football League in organized crime. And that's a book that was killed through a very hostile review in the New York Times. That story would take me too far off the subject, but suffice it to say that Moldea actually sued the Times over running a review that was so demonstrably and maliciously misleading. And his suit went all the way up to the Supreme Court. He was arguing that book reviewers should be held to the same standard of factual accuracy as regular reporters. He unfortunately lost his suit. The book basically stopped selling at about 18,000 copies after the review came out. It slipped right out of print, even though, let me add, that this is a book that when it came out in the 90s, Keith Olbermann, said, this is the best book on sports in the language.
Wow.
So it is a great book.
High praise.
And that's the first of the two books by Mulday we're doing. The second, as I say, is The Hoffa Wars, which has just come out. Finally, the fourth book that we've just released is called The Science of Coercion. This, too, is a book, this, too, is a second book we're doing by a particular author, because we did Christopher Simpson's book Blowback some months ago. That's his history of the U.S. recruitment of former Nazis and fascists for collaboration against the Soviet Union in the Cold War, and the disastrous effect that this partnership had on foreign and domestic policy. This is a great book. The Science of Coercion is very different, although it is related. It's about how the academic study of communications, which is actually my field now, you know, communication study, media study. This is a book about how, in America, the academic study of communication actually emerged directly out of military psychological warfare research. This is a fascinating book. It has a somewhat more academic interest than the others. On the other hand, there are so many college students majoring in communications in the United States, one of the most popular majors we have. But I think it's really important that people understand the genesis of the discipline itself, that it came out of efforts at using an understanding of communications to basically get an advantage over the Soviet Union in the Cold War. And this was an effort that, as his first book suggests, was abetted by some very shady characters from, you know, the Third Reich and so on. Because, as we all know, Dr. Goebbels had a very powerful, disastrously powerful understanding of how propaganda works. That kind of aggressive, warlike use of propaganda contributed to the introduction into American universities of propaganda study, so that much of the communications research that then went on in U.S. universities had a kind of warlike purpose, and was very different from a strain of media studies that had also been available through various scholars in Europe, the so-called Frankfurt School and so on, a kind of media study that's more about helping people understand how propaganda works so that they could defend themselves against it. I guess you could say I come out of that tradition.
Right.
And the Forbidden Bookshelf is a kind of public attempt, a kind of non-academic attempt to extend that sort of analysis beyond the university.
Hmm.
So these are four books that all in different ways really do help us understand things that are going on today. And I'm thrilled to say that they just came out a few days ago, and they're now part of the ever-growing library of books that we want to bring back.
The website, again, is www.forbiddenbookshelf.com. And Mark Crispin Miller, it's been a great pleasure to speak with you and to find out about this fascinating and commendable project. And I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show. I'm glad we got to talk. I hope we'll get to talk again in the future.
I sure do, too. And I thank you for having me on. I've really enjoyed this.
Coming up on Monday's Morning Show, I'll be speaking with Kevin Stewart, who is director of the Hospitality Center in Racine. It's been in the news much lately because their overnight homeless shelter is scheduled to close very shortly, and a public hearing on the issue and concern is going to be happening Tuesday night. We'll speak to Kevin Stewart on Monday. On Tuesday, the author of Food Junkies, which takes a look at the all-too-harsh reality of food addiction. On Wednesday, a former Navy SEAL talks about his book called Resilience, how hard-fought, hard-won wisdom for living a better life. Next Thursday, a very fine new composer by the name of Jennifer Higdon, whose very popular work Blue Cathedral is being performed this weekend by the Lake Geneva Symphony Orchestra. And a week from today, in a very special edition of of the morning show. We actually yield the airwaves to Education Matters for a special candidates forum for candidates for the Racine University.